everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
Okay, so my manga of the month is Shoujo Fights. This is a fairly recent English release. It's about a girls' volleyball team. So we've had a lot of sports series lately, but not a lot of women-focused ones. So this is really exciting. And it's not a fan service-y something. It's a really solid sports series.
Yeah, I feel like the market on that has, like, definitely decreased. I feel like partially just because women have just moved over to male sports series, but I feel like there's still, like, a really important niche for female teams, but I feel like that's kind of fallen the wayside. Hopefully that'll get a renaissance. But we are also, if you haven't seen it, although last month we talked about Anime NYC on the Speakeasy, we have a bunch of posts that expand on a lot of the stuff we only gave cursory looks at in the podcast. So if you wanted to know about the panels, and especially the concerts, and the little details about the convention, they're all there in those posts.
And I did an Artist Alley write-up as well. And we also have helped you guys out. The Write Stuff sale is in full swing, but there's also like 3,000 products. So we pulled out some of the good stuff, some of the stuff relevant to us, and that's all on the blog right now.
Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing. So, I'm gonna save everybody here a lot of time and review Junae Tyson's Zodiac War so you just don't have to watch it.
Well, thank you, Al. I don't even know what that is, so I don't think I was planning on watching it, but I still appreciate your sacrifice.
Okay, Kate, I'm gonna review it in a mere description, and then you will not want to watch it, and then I will go into detail why other people will hear this description and go, oh, I still might want to watch it, and I will then dissuade the rest of them.
Is it based on a light novel?
Better, Kate.
Visual novel.
Better.
Well, what could it be?
It is based on a light novel, but you didn't fully capture the essence. It is a fighting tournament arc series by Neo Ishii.
Ew!
Yes, it is based on a light novel, but it's a Neo Ishii light novel. It's a special level of hell for you, Kate.
Yeah, no wonder I don't know what this is.
a lot of people are like, oh, this looks really cool, and apparently the book sold really well, but Neo Ishii generally sells really well. So I'm like, alright, I'll watch one show on my own. I was like, it isn't on the list, but cause it wasn't on our SWAT review list, but it wasn't
for
like...
For a good reason.
But I was like, there's no reason to pitch this to Kate. Her review would be, it sucks, the end.
I watched it with my eyes closed and I still knew it was bad.
But I feel like I'm a little more like hit or miss on Neo Ishii. I kind of like admire what he does sometimes, and then other times I'm like, ugh, I definitely see why Kate doesn't like his work. So, let me start with what I think Neo Ishii's general shtick is.
In this series or just in life? Is this not actually a review? It's just a psychoanalyzation of Nishio Ishii.
So, from what I can tell, there's basically two faces to Neo Ishii. Apparently, he does his, like, anime stuff, and then he does his other writing stuff. And apparently, his other writing stuff is different. I've never seen it, and that doesn't get turned into animes. But his anime stuff is very much like, I'm going to take a genre and kind of... And I know, once again, I feel like this word is almost usable again. But I feel like he's big on deconstruction. Or more, if you don't like that term or feel it's overused, I feel like he likes to look at the mechanics or tropes of a genre and play with them. Maybe that's a better term. I mean, that's why I think we really didn't like Zorigato, because he very deliberately breaks the rules of mystery novels in a way that I think infuriates you and me, but other, like, amuses the hell out of other people. And I mean, all of his other series, Bakemonogatari, Kaganogatari, they all do a similar thing to the given genre they're based on. And once again, I feel like in a hit and miss way, at least for me. So I feel like this time his thing is you have a bunch of superpowered warriors and they all have to fight for some goal, some prize. That's the thing he's, something like Fate Stay Night or Basilisk. You could even go as far as to say stuff like that King's Game, even a battle royale is somewhat in that genre. Although those tend to be less people having superpowers. The premise of this is there are these families that control the world, and every number of years they send out their chosen warriors. Each one of them is a member of the Zodiac, and they fight in a town that is cleared by these people because they're just so powerful. And the one warrior who wins, his family gains a lot of power and prestige and influence over the world, and the fighter himself gets a prize, a wish. And all these warriors fight because obviously the families pay them a lot, and they also get whatever wish or prize they get for winning the competition. So that's the general premise. It's a pretty standard premise. It's all about execution. And so past this point, I'm going to spoil the hell out of this series. I'm sorry about it, but I feel like I kind of almost have to. Plus, I don't think anybody should watch it. So I don't feel like I'm spoiling, like, oh, but it's really all about the experience. In fact, in a way, it is. So I'm sure you've heard the expression, or like the idea that you have to learn the rules so you can break them. The idea is that if you understand the fundamentals of an art form,
but you have to understand them before you break them.
So yeah, you understand them and you know how to use them properly, and thereby you can then break them in ways that create better art. And I feel like this is almost a counter to that counter argument. Despite what you say, Neo Ishii knows the rules and then he breaks them. But this show, oh, sometimes those rules are very much in place because they make the story better. And when you break them, you realize, oh, maybe I shouldn't have, because that makes the story not fun or not interesting. And I feel like the Zodiac War is the prime example of that, because he basically, from the beginning, spells out who's going to die in what order, so you automatically know the victor. Because, one, since they are all zodiac animals, there is a set pattern to the Chinese zodiac, so they all die in the order of the zodiac. And to reinforce this, the ending shows them in the order of the zodiac, and about by the second or third time someone dies, you're like, oh, they're all just dying in the order that they're shown in the ending song. I noticed this like by the third one, and then anybody who knew the Chinese zodiac was like, oh, they're all dying in the order of the zodiac, and the ending just reinforces that.
Look, everyone knows the Chinese zodiac because everyone loves Fruits Basket.
But, I mean, would you know the order of the Chinese, like the years go?
Oh, I see.
I feel like even if I just picked up on it by the ending, I was like, they're all dying, like, right in the order of the ending. And then, yeah, the minute somebody mentioned the order of the zodiac, it all clicked into place. I'm like, oh, he is very deliberately pointing. And I think the idea is, like, you see, you're always excited about who's going to die and when. But the thing is, you always know who the victor of these series is going to be. So I'm going to break the rules and just lay it all out for you, because you know who's going to win. So his, like, clever idea is to show you the, basically lay out the roadmap. Ha ha ha. The problem is that structure is in place for tension. Even if you know in Basilisk that, you know, the main guy is going to be the guy who wins. In Fate Stay Night, you know that the main character is going to be the person who wins the Holy Grail War. It's still a question of what happens in the middle. Who are the characters who are going to die? You know, who's going to take out who? Who's going to be like a mutual kill? Who's going to be the first person to die? There's still a certain amount of tension. And when you remove all of that, it just almost seems like busy work paperwork at times. And I mean, I feel like if the series was written better, that might play out better. But, and I feel like this is more him being clever again. But there is this distinct, anytime a you learn a character's backstory, they are gonna be dead in like 30 seconds.
Well, that's a very common trope.
I mean, and once again, I feel like it's supposed to be a ha ha ha, this is a common trope and I'm doing it so you know it's gonna happen. But it just, once again, it just feels tedious then. It's like, all right, so we got this character's backstory. I just should start a clock down timer for when they're gonna die.
Let me just stop you there for and ask you a question now. So, as somebody though who doesn't mind spoilers, not me. Everyone knows that I don't like spoilers, but you don't mind if you get spoilers. So, how do you think this differs? Like, it's almost as if he is being the He's the Twitter person who's like, "Al, you haven't watched the show. Well, here's how everybody dies." So, how do you feel like it's different than you kind of like knowing about it ahead of time?
You know,
or if it, is it just the storytelling?
Yeah. It is totally the storytelling. Put it this way. In a normal story, there's a tone. There's this build up and rise and then fall that almost is like a lilt, a accent to the story that draws you in. The problem with the Zodiac War is because Neo Ishin is doing this, it's like the whole story is told in monotone.
Okay.
And thereby, everything falls flat. Also, it does not help that there was only one character that was in any way enjoyable, who was the monkey, who was this woman who was pacifist, who's always just trying to stop wars, and she gets killed about halfway through, and then all you're left with is all the other scumbag characters. And once again, I feel like it was supposed to be a, like, oh, see, this character's super likable and has, like, goals that you like, so I'll kill them halfway through! Because you think there would be the one of the characters who would survive till the end. But no, they die. And it's like, well, they weren't the one likable character. So now I'm just left with all the shitty.
Why am I here?
Mm-hmm. And once again, I feel like it's Neo Ishin trying to be super clever. And I know what you're expecting. And then I didn't give it to you. But like, once again, there's a reason that that type of character is usually in there. Is because the audience wants somebody, anybody to latch onto. Even a character who is a bad guy, who is enjoyable. Like, you don't have to be a good guy. You can be a bad guy or a morally gray character as long as you can latch on to them and want to go on their journey. But all these other characters are just, awful. They're these two guys who are brothers and they're all just about causing chaos and getting money. And one of them dies before the first episode. He's already dead. The rabbit guy already killed him. And then they spend two episodes on his brother and learning the backstory of his the brother who already died. And they're just douchey idiots. And you're like, these two got two friggin' episodes? And then, so you find out everybody in this series has like essentially two powers. Like the power they let off and then their secret power that they use as a trump card to surprise people. And his is he can fly. And they go through the whole backstory and he's about to swoop in unexpectedly and reveal his spying thing. And the bunny guy just flies through the air through a different tactic and cuts him off. They go through two episodes of him and his brother's backstory. And he just dies in the first like 10 seconds of the episode after that. And he's dead. And then that guy, the bunny guy, has necromantic powers. So his corpse fights on, but it's generally like totally not interesting. And even after that, his corpse and his brother's corpse are dealt with like in like 10 minutes after that, and not even in an interesting way. And then it just sets up the Tiger Girl as a notice me senpai storyline. Her original story was kind of an interesting PTSD storyline, but then it just turns into a notice me senpai story.
Great. All this, it sounds great.
But yeah, it's just, all of it could somehow work if the characters were enjoyable. And the guy who wins, he's just wandering through the background and just seems to be avoiding stuff. And then essentially you find out he has the visual novel power, which is he can basically create save points. And then if he dies, he can just go back to that save point. So he's basically been save scumming the whole Zodiac War. And essentially, like, the rabbit guy, who's just not even worth talking about, but he's just overpowered so he can slaughter off everybody else. And the ox guy, who's, you kind of learn is interesting. They're, like, locked in a battle together, and he just throws a bomb that he stole off somebody else, blows them both up, and then he wins.
The whole thing?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Because basically he could get to the point where, like, the two hardest guys were locked in combat, and so he got a bomb, and he blows them up, and he's like, I won. And there's one more episode where you find out what his wish is, but it was, and once again, it seemed deliberately like, you expect a clever fight with all these things, but this guy just had a lame I win power, and he wins by lamely throwing a bomb at the right moment. Ha ha ha, isn't that fun? Isn't that a twist on the normal formula? Yes, it does break the normal formula, but you have to break the normal formula in a cool way or an interesting way. If you break the normal formula, and the way you break the normal formula is boring, then you only realize why you use the normal formula most of the time, because if you break the formula and it's boring, why break the formula in the first place?
I can tell you're very upset, Al.
A lot of people didn't pick up on the Niuishin formula, but I do feel that a lot of people, like, this just felt like going through the motions. It felt boring, and I realized why he's doing it, but if you do it to be boring, you wind up being boring. Which is, as clever as you think you are, still a horrible sin and still makes a horrible show. But apparently this book did really well and it's already getting a sequel. And it does not help that a lot of times the series looks super cheap. There are some episodes where you're like, ooh, you guys, I forget which studio does it, but you are definitely using your B team here. There are like one or two fluid scenes and stuff like that. The director or something was like, hey buddy, could you just animate this one scene for me? And I'll just have the B team do the rest of this episode. Yeah, and there are some fights where you're like, ooh, that was a B-team fight, wasn't it? So it's not even like it's so beautiful but boring. It is kind of mediocre looking and boring too. So I did not mind spoiling it because clearly it's not even worth watching to see what he did, because what he did isn't worth replicating. It is only a good object lesson in why the rules exist. And I'm not saying that you can't break the rules, because that could give you some real interesting stories. You just can't do it this way.
Don't watch his stuff. That's my piece of advice.
Just do not. Niuishin is poison. Do not support Niuishin.
Do not touch. Just skip. So I have been playing, like so many other people across the country, a lot of Animal Crossing Pocket Camp. And since it's been taking up so much of my time, I figured I'd talk about it here, because then it somehow makes it relevant. And therefore, it's not just a big time suck. I'm also doing a service to the blog and podcast. So for anybody who is not really familiar with the Animal Crossing franchise, this is the mobile app that Nintendo has made for the game. You don't have to have played any other Animal Crossings. In fact, all Animal Crossing games exist in this way. You do not ever have to have played another Animal Crossing to play the newest one.
But then won't I not know the rich lore and backstory of KK Slider?
I mean, you won't. And you also won't already have your favorite villagers, which everybody fights about who's the best. And there's so many villagers. In fact, until I started playing the mobile game, for whatever reason, I had never fully deep dived into just how many there are. And there are plenty that I do not know, even being a fan of the franchise. So if you were interested, if you've seen people talking about Pocket Camp, you can totally just pick it up. No reason to worry about any of the other games. And the premise of this is that you are tasked by a dog named Isabel, and she wants you to run your own campsite. And on the campsite, you can sort of build up your patio and also build amenities like cool tents, and eventually apparently you can get up to building a tree house and a big picnic set and stuff like that for different animals in the neighborhood to come and visit and hang out in. And the way that you do that is you collect things on the little islands that you can travel to. So you can go fishing, you can catch bugs, and then you help the villagers with tasks. So you'll run into a villager and they'll tell you, I need 3 of these types of fish, and you go get them, and then you kind of trade with them. Once you do these things, they give you stuff like wood and cotton and steel, and you take those things and you can build stuff. So,
all I could think is it felt like a Settlers of Catan. Like, you should be like, I want to trade 3 wood for 2 sheep.
I should have said it in a more monotone way. That way, it wouldn't have seemed like, yeah, it would have seemed more. It's more silly than, like, that probably sounded, is I guess what I'm saying, is that it's more just, like, very cute. The game is just super, super adorable. The animals say funny things, and they ask you funny questions, and they have little funny reactions to stuff, and they all have different personalities. And so that the whole like goal of the game is what's the goal of every Animal Crossing game, which is it's whatever you want it to be as the player. If you want to collect all the furniture that looks like Christmas, which is like the event going on right now, then you can do that. Or if you're like me and you want to collect all of the food items, you can do that. If you want to collect all the animals that are cranky old people, also a goal of mine, you can do that. So really, you know, Animal Crossing is sort of like slice of life the game, I guess. And, you know, and it's just really cute and fun. And that's the concept of the game. And I shared a couple articles about people saying that, you know, I don't really have anxiety issues, but there's been some articles about people who have anxiety and how much they loved having an Animal Crossing game because it's very calm and cute and it's just fun. And there's something about it that's very relaxing to people. That does not mean that you cannot get obsessed with it and just try to be playing it all the time and try to maximize all of your items. So there's also... there's also a competitive aspect to it. So I think Nintendo, you know, is really getting the hang of the mobile market, which is cool. This is the first mobile I played from them. And one of the number one things I like about it is that it in no way makes me feel like I need to spend money.
Yeah, it's interesting. That was actually a question I was going to ask about because I listened to like the Giant Bombcast, which is a video game podcast. Most people probably know that, but I figure I'd premise that. And they all reviewed it and they all hated the game. And they felt like, oh man, this game makes you spend money all the time. And the only way to get anything or do anything is to spend the real monies. And if you want the characters you want and you want to get the items for like the Christmas events, you got to spend the real cash monies. I hate this game and I'm never going to play it. And I'm like, man, everybody that I know who plays the game in the area isn't like, now I got to sink in another $40 into Animal Crossing. So I'm like, which story is the real? I'm trusting my friends more than random and internet reviewers. And maybe they're, I don't know, like maybe their game styles are quite different.
I mean, I guess so first of all, I want to say that I have not spent $1 on this game. I'm at level 40. I have all except 2 of the villagers that I want so far, and have a good amount of the items that I want. Including in the Christmas event, I'm only missing 1 item, which I will get by the end of the week. Again, having spent $0 on this game. So, prefacing with that, but I guess I would wonder, since I don't know, you know, the people who felt that way. 1, if they've ever played Animal Crossing before, and 2, like, are they just, like, really impatient? Because the game definitely plays on if you are an impatient player. Now, if you're not impatient, it rewards you. So... the thing that you can definitely spend money on in here, or that you could spend money on. So there's in-game currency, which is bells. And then there's also these things called leaf tickets. So leaf tickets represent real world money. But you get a lot of free leaf tickets throughout the game. Especially, of course, you know, like when you first play the game, of course, they're giving you leaf tickets because theoretically now you will be caught in the cycle of using leaf tickets or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of sunk cult fallacy from from listening to like video game podcasts and extra credits where they want you to invest. They want you to get invested in the game and have those lease tickets in the beginning so that you feel like really invested. So you're more likely to keep playing and or especially pay money for Leaf tickets.
So of course, yeah, at the beginning you get a lot, but the Leaf tickets primarily exist in the game from my experience with it to speed up things that are happening. So those things will happen, but they take a longer time to happen. So after you have done a few things, built a few pieces of furniture, gotten a few animals, done a couple of amenities, you kind of start leveling those things up. And the bigger items take longer to appear or be built. So some things I have had to build take 48 hours to build. So you can't like do anything on that particular thing for like 48 hours. Or there'll be a piece of furniture. Or the one I think that the internet has caught onto the most, which is a pizza, okay? So this pizza, I think it takes like 12 hours to craft this pizza. It must be the most artisanal pizza of all time. Don't understand, but okay. Like,
they must be like, all right, I'm gonna soak these sun-dried tomatoes in like a balsamic vinaigrette for in the freezer for 12 hours before I make this pizza.
Yeah, it's some crazy thing. So if you don't want to wait for things to happen, I feel like that's where you can get caught up in using the Leaf tickets, because that's what you can use it on. Or you can use them if you don't have enough of the crafting material. So, you know, obviously each thing you want to craft costs like whatever, however many different things for whatever reason. So if you don't have enough of that stuff, instead of being patient and helping villagers and, you know, gathering them, gaining those things, you could just pay Leaf tickets and get the item. So you could definitely spend money if you want to, but I actually find it very easy not to in this game because, see, Nintendo has been foolish, except apparently Giant Bomb people disagree with this. But as a person who has played a lot of Animal Crossing games, the problem with Animal Crossing is that you could literally play it the entire day. Like, forever. No, I have never done that. I have never played Animal Crossing nonstop for 24 hours. That has never happened. I'm just saying theoretically.
I've heard stories of other
people. Yeah, definitely. Heard from my friend. So the fact that certain things take 8 hours, 12 hours, actually gives you a break from play. I'm like, oh, okay, well now I'm like, cool, and I can come back later, and then I'll worry about this thing. And this game also doesn't have, in all the other games, there's certain things that you have to sort of maintain. Everyone calls them kind of your Animal Crossing chores. So, oh, I gotta go make sure that, like, this is good, and I have to go visit people, otherwise they might move, and I gotta make sure this tree is watered, and yada, yada, yada. Well, you don't have to do any of that here. So again, you're not punished for not logging in. There's no like detriment to not being there, which I like, so I'm not complaining. But I feel like there's all these things about the game that allow me to take breaks from it, whereas I could easily be there all the time. So I totally disagree. I really don't feel like the game is constantly, and I don't feel like it's constantly trying to get me to spend money. It's not constantly like popping up things about tickets and this and that and whatever. Like, it just doesn't feel like that to me.
Well, I think it was like, is it KK Slaughter and somebody else you can only get with Leaf tickets?
Yes, but at the beginning of the you can get them from the first time you log in, and they give you a ton of Leaf tickets at the beginning of the game. So if you real, I got, that's how I got KK Slaughter, was they gave me a ton, so I got him, and he sits in my village and plays the, I almost said plays the piano. Why the hell did I say that? Plays the guitar in front of my Christmas tree. That's what he does. So yeah, you can, there's certain, those are the, so far there's been those two characters and certain paint jobs for your camper that you can only get through Leaf tickets. Otherwise there hasn't been anything else, and that's just a paint job. That's not like you can't have a camper or something. Like, you, I have one, you just can't have these certain special paint jobs. So All the Christmas stuff you can gain through helping your villagers.
Because, yeah, they were like, I heard that you could, the only way to get everything is you've got to buy tickets.
Well, I don't know. Who are, like, what is the underground network of Animal Crossing I don't know. Why don't you log into your game for 5 seconds and notice that you get these candy cane whatevers, I forget what they are now, from your villagers for free.
Okay.
No, just trust the underground
knows the truth.
They know. That's right. I have not gotten all the items for $0.
And the other big complaint they had, which I like
how this has become a rebuttal against the Giant Bomb podcast. Go on. Yes.
Is they were super mad. They're like, the villagers extort you to come and visit them. They demand stuff, and that's the only way to get you. And Animal Crossing is all about friendships and villagers liking you, and they should just come on their own. You shouldn't have to pay them off to get you to come to your campsite.
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
do you feel like they're like bad friends who demand?
No, I don't. I can't disagree that there are definitely mechanics in this game that wouldn't exist in a console version of the game that do play on more mobile style gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I can't deny that is true. I just don't feel extorted by it. It doesn't feel like super egregious to me.
And I feel like it's not like it's like you buy like bells and then you go to like, I don't know, the camp loot box system and, you know, you only have a 2% chance of getting a Sam the Eagle.
Yeah, I was gonna say, one of the really nice things about this game, and probably one of the reasons that I like it, is there is no random gotcha anything like that that so many mobile games have, including other Nintendo, like Fire Emblem.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like that. So, you know, it's not, I'm going to spend this money and maybe I'll get the piece of furniture that I want, or maybe I'll get the, you know, I feel like at the very least they've set it up for, if you want this thing, you get this thing. I think what I'm looking for in improvements, and actually when we're recording this, the next day, they're actually doing a massive update. The you're not going to be able to play Animal Crossing for like 8 hours or something. It's going to be down for maintenance. So, and they've also said that they were doing a big update. So I'm not sure if that's also the update or this is just server maintenance, but big things happening. And I am looking for some improvements though. I'm hopeful about a few things. So one of the things that I think is really disappointing right now in the game is that when you go visit other people's campsites, you can't talk to the villagers. So you can't talk to their animals and you can't really do anything. So there's not really any incentive for you to go visit other people's campsites at all. I mean, you can see the stuff that they have, but like, there's not really a lot that you get out of doing it. And so it'd really be nice to, at the very least, have those villagers talk so they can say funny things. And doing one better would be like being able to go fishing or being able to go shopping or do some things in your friends' villages. Now, here's the other thing though, that I will say, I'm really looking forward to them announcing a Switch Animal Crossing, because of course they're going to, and it's going to be amazing, and it's going to just suck away every bit of my time. But in here, everybody's campsite is set up the same way. Everybody has access to the same villagers. Everybody has access to the same furniture and the same clothes, and it's the same setup for everybody. So I'm not advocating for them to like totally randomize stuff. But again, there's just like not a lot of incentive for you to like leave your own area, because there's not much else going on anywhere and you can't like really interact. So one of the updates they're doing is they're adding gardening, which is great but dangerous, because that's one of the number one time sucks of the console ones. And your biggest chores is, if you want those flowers to stay nice, you gotta get in there and water them every day. So that's a little dicey. And then the thing they're supposed to add after that is being able to make your own clothing or crafting clothing. So I don't, like in the most recent games, you can make your own clothes, like with patterns and stuff. So I don't know if they're introducing that or just, oh, you can get certain clothing items made for you that are just like pre-made designs, but they haven't really explained exactly what that is yet, so.
And then characters will wear the dumbest t-shirts as is.
Oh my lord. If people can start changing clothes, that would be interesting. The other thing is that I've seemed to have reached the limit of how many animals they put in the game, because I've gained a few levels. Like, so the way it was working for most of the game is that when you gained a level, you gained a level by upping your friendship with different animals. So you had to get, like, I don't know, whatever it is, like 10, you know, friendship meters with these characters, and then you like go up a level. So I got to a point where I had done that, and usually it would add an animal or two to the game that you've now unlocked. Well, now it's not adding new characters to the game for me.
Did you make, I know you've been making a lot of food. Did you make yogurt? Because if you make enough yogurt, maybe you can get danimals.
There's no yogurt in this game.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's really a tragedy. So, yeah, and actually the reason that I was talking about earlier about how many villagers there are was that I had said, I realized, you know, that the creators can't just infinitely forever add characters to this game. And then a friend of ours was like, oh, yes, they can. It's like, look how many there are. And it's like, okay, yeah, yeah, there's no real excuse for you to not have some villagers for me at this point. But the game has only been out like a month?
Yeah.
So I'm give them a break. And the good thing is that when they do add villagers, because they did add 4, like after the game launched, and if you're already past the level from which you would have gotten them, you just automatically get them. They start showing up. So whenever they do add new characters, I should just be getting them automatically. So I do hope that they do that very soon, because I think a lot of people are going to be hitting the max.
So I have a question for you, Kate. If you don't know the answer to this, this is fine. But are there any, like, other than, like, those mechanic, are they birds? The ones who upgrade your camper and all that? Are there any villagers who are, like, pocket camp exclusive that are not legacy characters?
I actually don't know. I haven't looked into that, and I'm just not familiar enough with the catalog of characters to know it myself. I guess I could have just Googled it. That's a really good question. Because thing is that something I was really frustrated about was, I have my favorite villagers. Everybody who's played the franchise has their favorites. And for the longest time in my game, none of my villagers from my towns, like, ever were in the game. So that's how huge I think it was.
The
also
catalog.
Like, I realized, is like, my God, like, am I ever gonna get unlock villagers that I've ever had? And there's some that I recognize from other friends' villages and things like that. But yeah, my own, I still only have 2 that were, and one of them I didn't like, and then the other one I like, but I haven't, like, gotten them yet, or gotten them to permanently be attached to my camp. So yeah, it's just a huge amount of characters, and they need to add more ASAP. So, I mean, I'm loving it. I love, love, love the game. I think it's for me, is a really happy medium between being a new console version and being a horrible, money-sucking mobile game. So I'm having a really great time with it. I'm really interested to see if there's going to be a Christmas Eve event. So they've had a Christmas event the whole month, and you can get special furniture. But in the console versions, stuff happens on Christmas Eve. So I'm really interested to see if it's going to be different or look different. And I just love the details of the game. I mean, that's one of the Animal Crossing's sort of signatures, is just lots of little details between the villagers and just the backgrounds and stuff. So it's all islands in here, but late, like mid-December, it all started to have snow. So there's snow on the ground, even by the beach and stuff. And then there was all these outdoor seating areas by the beach or whatever, and they had fruity drinks on them. Well, now they've changed, and there's like a thermos with 2 little mugs. You know, just nice, like, little, getting those little details is what people love about the Animal Crossing series. So it's been very, very delightful. But it does just make me really, really, really want to switch Animal Crossing.
I feel like that's a very common sentiment.
Yeah, because what I'm really hoping, I'm just gonna talk about this here because why not, is that for Switch Animal Crossing, whenever they announce it, I'm really hoping there might be a cooking aspect that they could add, because if they just want to take even more of our time, people love the events in game where you get to gather ingredients and help cook things. And that usually only happens on special event things. But if they added something like that
permanently and then just had special recipes you could only make on holidays.
Oh my God. It would be crazy. It would be insane. It would be the best. And they did such a good job in Zelda Breath of the Wild with the cooking thing that I feel confident that they could add a really great cooking element.
So obviously we're now just talking like Nintendo's listening because they do, because you know we're the number one anime podcast, so of course they have to listen in for our taste making decisions. Kate, you mentioned you didn't get any of your animals. Since they're listening, if you could name two animals that like need to be added ASAP, who would they be?
Wolfgang, he's a wolf, obviously. He's a cranky villager, super great. And Molly, who is this adorable apple cheeked duck, has two big round red spots on her cheeks, and she existed in my village forever. Like, I never, one of my first villagers, never ever allowed to leave, and a lot of my village in my more recent games is always like Halloween themed, so I try to get like cranky and like weird looking villagers, but then I just couldn't let this adorable duck leave, so it was like, that duck must be badass because she lives in this town of weirdos. So she absolutely needs to be in the game. And we only have, I think we only have one other duck right now. I think Ketchup is the only duck who's really great. But yeah, ASAP, Nintendo. So last, but oh so not least, is the amazing feat that we finished Space Runaway Ideon. Well, we haven't watched the movies yet. We will. Don't worry.
That's for the next week, easy.
But we finished the TV series, 39 episodes, and the last time we talked about the show, we were past the halfway point, but not too far from it, so we got through quite a lot since the last time we discussed it here.
And I mean, to continue the Evangelion similarities and parallels and inspirations, Ideon was a show that got canceled, and Tomino basically had to throw on a super last minute ending, and like the real ending where certain things get explained or at least expanded on, much like Evangelion is in the movies. But I feel like as we were kind of discussing when we watched the end of the TV series, nobody knew at the time that those movies were coming. So let's kind of just discuss the TV series as if you had watched it on TV, this is what you would have got, and then we can kind of compare and contrast to the eventual movies when those come out.
Yeah, it was interesting. The method by which we watched Ideon, there was a warning at the beginning of the 39th episode to, hey, you know, watch the movies first before you watch this, otherwise you'll be spoiled. And while yes, I suppose that is true. I, having not seen the movies, I trust that this person knows. But I thought that was such a funny warning because you're kind of supposed to see them afterwards. You're supposed to sort of know, I feel like I wanted to know what the real ending was, because we weren't, you know, to have that experience of seeing like what was really shown.
Yeah, I feel like it would be like watching Evangelion and then not watching the last two episodes and then just being like, forget about those. Those aren't important. Watch them afterwards. Now go out and watch the movie.
Yeah. I kind of get it. I get where they're coming from, but I think maybe just on an intellectual level, I want to know how I would react to what had happened. So, okay, before we get to the ending, just to very briefly summarize what kind of happens up until that point is, so last time we saw them and talked about it, the Ideon was being relentlessly pursued by the Buff Clan, and they kept going to like different planets, and horrible things were happening to everybody that they kind of encountered or helped them along the way.
But the Ideon keeps getting new powers. They get, I definitely know they had the all-out attack where they can basically just shoot all the missiles and all the guns at once suits, which should normally just not be a power they can do. And I don't remember if it's in this half or the other half where they get the ED gun, which is just this crazy...
That had not happened yet, I believe. So the last big thing was the missile barrage sort of thing.
They just keep getting all these new powers, and they realize that, when the legends say the Edeon has like infinite power, it's not like hyperbole.
Yeah, and I think that just continues to increase as we go, because the crew is, it's almost like the more desperate they are, the Edeon is reacting to that as well. And they're being pursued. They eventually decide they're so desperate that they are going to go to Earth anyway. They were kind of avoiding it because they didn't want to lead the Buff Clan to Earth. And now they just feel they have no other options. They need to go there because there's military there. There is theoretically help there.
But Kate, you forgot the most important character who's super important. And like, her death forever marks Cosmo.
Kasha didn't die, Al.
No, the death of Kitty Kitten, which for some reason they think is important.
Who's they?
Tomino.
Okay. I suppose he does like to have sort of a... He likes to fridge some woman that the main character is... smitten with, shall we say. I think we see this more. I feel like Kitty Kitten was sort of the proto for Masumane sort of character.
I don't know if like people are like, yes, 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 or shots fired.
I hate both of those characters. Bring it on. Worst part is Zeta. Okay, wait, maybe not, but...
Kate, there's so many. Don't actually say that. There's so many. Just worst female character is even hard. Like, there is Sarah. There is Rosa Marie, who has that weird...
The weird brother hallucinations. All right, wait. Anyway, okay. So, yeah, okay, this girl dies. It's sort of almost kind of the last nail in the coffin of, we are destroying planets. Every time we try to get help, something horrible goes wrong. Things are just escalating, I guess. And that, after that is sort of when they decide, okay, this is sort of like, enough is enough.
But I also feel like, on a certain level, Cheryl's also pushing, and I feel like Bess is running out of options, and once again, I feel like even more than Bright, and I mean, it's clear that Bess is a military grunt, not a military leader, and so like his leadership can only take the ship so far, and thereby like, I feel like if they had like some kind of brilliant, they had like a Yang Wenli or a Bright, they might have been able to have more tactics, but... Even more than the white base, it is clear that like everybody who is on the Edeon and the solo ship is not a military person, or at least not a great leader. And thereby, maybe if like circumstances were different, they would have been able to think more on their feet or come up with some other plan. But I feel like they're kind of just backed into a strategic corner.
And I think that it's sort of compounded, though, because they can't figure out the Edeon. It's just this mysterious thing that they keep trying to figure out how it works, and it's not revealing itself to them. And I think that also sort of exasperates them, and the situation is... I feel as though, with the Gundam, they know how a Gundam works. For the most part. But the Edeon basically has a mind of its own. And so I think that also kind of changes... Like, it's really hard to have a strategy when you have no idea what's going to happen. And I think we see that later, because after they go to Earth, and Earth screws them over, and they leave, and then they get terrified of the Edeon. They're afraid of it at that point, and they try to destroy it, which is one of the worst and weirdest episodes, and feels like the episode that happened right after they found out that they had to cancel this show was getting canceled.
Because that episode felt like it was an episode that was originally supposed to have a bunch of setup, but they just this was supposed to be a two-part episode, make it one, and no... prep time, just drop everybody in the middle of the plot and figure it out as they go. But I feel, just before we get into that weird episode, I feel like the problem is also they meet the right people at the wrong time and the wrong people at the right time. Because everybody who is conducive to helping the Edeon, like Earth colonies and stuff, they meet them at the time that they can't protect them. Like that lady who is very motherly to Cosmos, who dies, we mentioned, they would have helped the Edeon crew, but everybody was too weak at that point and that base gets wiped out. But by the time they're powerful enough to work alongside the Earth forces, everybody in Earth either fears them and wants them to go away or just kill them in general, or lusts after the power of the Edeon and basically wants it for themselves and thereby wants to get rid of the Solo crew so they can control the Edeon. So basically, at the time when they could work together, now they're only meeting people who basically won't work with them.
You're right. I feel like the later half, or the latter quarter of the series, is really dedicated to people, because we get not only the Buff Clan who has been pursuing them, who wants the Edeon, but then the Earth not only screws them over, but then pursues them and actually tries to kill them and then teams up with the Buff Clan in another super weird episode and really take advantage of how desperate the crew is and experienced they are. I mean, I think that really shows. Although, you know, sometimes it's hard to know because Tomino characters do dumb things just to do dumb things, even though you feel like they wouldn't do that. Like the episode where Bess gets called by the Earth military. They're like, you know what? No, it's cool. It's cool. I think you should come down here and we should discuss this in person. You should just come, just you. And Cosmo's like, no, me too.
Yeah, and they're like, that's a great idea. It probably is a trap. So we'll not only send half of our most, you know, important people, we'll send both. I'm surprised they didn't try to rope in Kasha to just like, if all three of us die, the Solo ship is totally screwed.
Let's all go. I was just baffled.
Well, you know what it is, Kate. If all three of them died, then Bento and that blue-haired guy, whose name I don't even know, and the other pilot dude, who I, like, looked up his name, but I can't remember who he is, because he isn't important. They all, those three, they could have held down the ship.
Yeah. Oh, man, remember the episode about one of those random dudes?
Moira?
The episode where you know this guy's gonna die because he's never had lines before, and now suddenly there's some story?
My favorite line during that episode was you going, oh, that's what he looks like with his helmet not on.
I didn't even know who that was, okay?
But how about this, Kate? What if the ship was owned, the Solo ship in the Edeon was only run by Cheryl and Carlala?
On board for that. Can Kasha stay? Because Kasha is by far one of the most entertaining characters.
Well, she didn't go along with Cosmo and Vest, the obvious trap.
The two of them, I just, not the brightest bulbs on the Solo ship. As far as, oh, okay, so, you know, we're talking about how they're sort of scared of the Edeon. They don't quite know how it works. But here's one thing they do know. If you put babies inside of it, in the cockpit, the Edeon just works much better. It loves screaming children. Children in peril. That's what it likes.
Kate. What you don't know is the Edeon is powered by rage, and screaming babies create the most amount of rage.
I mean, you know, I feel like this is pretty much, it's an old show, we're not worried about spoilers here. Do you feel like you completely figured out what really drives the Edeon?
I think some of that is explained a lot more in the movie, so.
But we must speculate now, Al.
It feels like totally something that Tomino was holding some of the cards back for the last few episodes. Like, he's got five cards, right? And definitely, he lays about two or three of them on the table. Like, Bess gets that weird, the Edeon gives him a bunch of visions for some reason. He's like, who on the ship? Bess! That's the guy I'll give all these enigmatic visions to. this is a good choice. Harula, Cheryl, they'd be able to interpret them well. Nope, nope. All right, definitely not Kasha. She'd just go, ah! Kill all the Bob Clan. That's what the eye told me. I will only get one interpretation, no matter what I give her. So, Bess, you'll have enough information that you'll give back some information, but not be able to interpret enough so I can still have some mysteries left. And GJ and Cheryl have a little more, like, when they start, like, really kind of pooling their heads together, they give you, like, the second card. And then a little bit with, at the end with the bombs and Harlula, I feel like that's the third card with some of that weirdness at the end. But I feel like Tomino was still holding those two remaining cards for like the last few episodes. But since we just get that rushed ending, we don't really get those two cards that would explain everything.
Yeah, because it stays so mysterious. And I felt like we were doing a lot of speculating, you know, because especially after we see how it reacts to children in peril. And then we sort of see that there's a point in the show when the Eidon doesn't even have all of its pilots and it reacts. So we know that it's not dependent on, like, people actually piloting it, which was weird. You know, there's a human cooperation not human cooperation, but, like, there's some sort of survival and cooperation between people that is relevant. I mean, it's very mysterious.
Well, I mean, because we were actually, this is a good point to bring up now, because I also mentioned it in the card thing, that you were like, why did the Eidon, like, try to contact Bess first, as much as, you know, I just made fun of it. And I think the reason is, technically, because he was the thirstiest. No. Well, it actually kind of works out because he was thirsty, but I feel like he was the first person to actually try to work with the Buff Clan and understand them as fellow sentient beings as opposed to an enemy. I mean, he was doing it because he really, really wanted in Karlala's pants, but even if his motives weren't pure, at least he was like the first one to really extend the hand of interspecies friendship. And I think that is why the Eidon was attracted to him. Because, I mean, even at that point, I don't think anybody else, the crew kind of begrudgingly, like, eventually accepts Harlula, only because she throws herself on the line to...
She works at it, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is a little odd that they didn't pick Harlula, since she is actually the one who is the biggest peace broker. But I feel like that's why I think it picked Bess. I feel like if it had, like, contacted, like, a second person, it might have actually gone for Cheryl or GJ.
Well, I think this is before...
Yeah, before
GJ sort of joins the crew, so it couldn't have been him.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like if it had gone to a second person, it might have gone to one of them.
Yeah, if it eventually... You mean eventually, like, later on. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think there's also a lot of mysterious stuff in the show that will just remain mysterious. I mean, it doesn't need to all be explained, and I don't think that it will be. Because I feel as though it's sort of this emotional roller coaster. And again, maybe that's also a portion of it that's, like, very influencing Ava there, is that, like, all the answers are not really, like, the most important takeaway from what's going on. Because even in the last, like, you know, so I think it's episode, like, 36, it's really close to the end, is that episode where they try to blow up the Eidon and the Solo ship, and, like, clearly this is the moment when they just got from on high that they didn't have much time left. And they go out of their way to show, I think, the mental strain from that point on the characters of this journey. It's so psychological past that point.
I mean, yeah, the beginning of that episode, there's that one dude who basically just, like, essentially is like, I think I'm going to walk home, and not I'm going to step off the ship onto this planet and walk to my house. Like,
they're in space.
Yeah, he's just like, he is clearly has major, like, post-traumatic stress disorder. Cosmo has to, like, whoa, snap out of it. Like, get back inside. You are clearly clearly not doing well.
And the sequence with the bombs not exploding and people trying to prevent it from happening, because they almost, this crew of this solo ship basically decides that no, never mind, they can't leave the ship and the Edeon. And it really feels like a decision that they do not want to make. That they make it because they have to, but that's not, what they wanted to do was leave. And just get away from it all and forget it ever happened. And they get sort of pulled back in to doing it. And there's that weird sequence with the, like, the outlines of the characters. It just looks very different than the rest of the show looked.
They do use that effect once or twice after that point. But you could tell, in a way, yeah, like, the style has changed past that point. It is almost this point of no return. Or, actually, the point of the no return is probably the first episode, but now they realize, the crew realizes it, that, like, oh, we can't get away. We've always thought we could. This is our revelation that whatever road this thing is taking us on, there is no turning back or turning away from it.
And characters like Cheryl has a total breakdown, drinking herself into oblivion at one point. Yeah, it's just a really psychological look into being in this situation. So I have to say, it was pretty intense. I feel like there's a lot of jokes about this show, and well deserved. I wrote some choice things down. I mean, totally get it. But I was also pretty impressed with some of those decisions, especially, you know, as the series goes on.
I mean, Daryl Surratt once talked about this on Anime World Order. Edeon is a show that people know about, but very few people have seen. So I feel like a lot of times, a lot of the talk about Edeon comes from, like, somebody reads the summary or this general idea of Edeon, but actually watching it gives you a very different impression. And like you said, Edeon is hardly a perfect show. There is some weirdness. There's definite pacing issues. There's a lot of repetition. But I feel like, like we mentioned when we started this first episode, you can see the influence of Edeon on a lot of what comes after it. Not as blatantly as something like Evangelion, but the fact that, you know, it got that big reference in Shirobako, that other series referenced it, and I think it shows that it left an impression on a lot of people, especially in Japan, that watched it. And I feel like, in a way, partially for its flaws as much as its virtues, but especially for some of the more interesting and meaty ideas that it left.
I want to just, you know, before we talk about the ending, I just want to call out a couple of great moments in the series. So first of all, my girl, evil sister, Harula, she gets, like, so many points, but the show gets negative points because they do not bring her back soon enough near the end, where we got randos. And it's like, no, we don't have enough time for this. We need crazy evil sister bitch.
Well, I
need her.
They clearly wanted her to be the last villain. But since it is a sunrise show, you have to have, like, the druggies, as we always say. And I feel like, yeah, there is just a bunch of, like,
there's the idol guy. There's Snack Man.
There's the guy with the sword. Yeah, there's a bunch of just, like, one gimmick buff clan leaders that are just like, all right, get on with it. You're clearly just here for, like, 1 to 3 episodes because you don't want to bring Harlula back until the end.
And I have to applaud her for that amazing episode of Revenge where she sends her spy to this other buff clan. Remember, like, basically everybody's buff clan, but there's a whole bunch of factions and they're all infighting. So Harlock gets kind of taken off the pursuit of the Edei. She is not happy about it. And this other ship makes fun of the guy that she liked. So she sends an assassin who straight up shoots the captain of this ship on the bridge in front of people. She fought, like, man, that was a really satisfying moment up until the point where then the Edeon just destroys that entire fleet. It's a pretty epic revenge plot.
In Harlula's defense, it wasn't...
She doesn't need defending, Al. She's perfectly fine.
But for people who haven't seen it, it wasn't like they made fun of her boyfriend. It was that he died and then he left her this, like, heartfelt message of, like, you know, everything I did was for you and I'm sorry we didn't have enough time together. And her rival lady intercepts and is like, what a loser! What a sappy garbage message from a sappy garbage guy! And Harlula's like, I'm gonna fucking regret it.
But let's be real. Even if she had just tripped that guy, I think Harlula would still have sent assassins.
Well, yes, but let at least put the time that she sent assassins in context. It was a little more than, his breath is bad. Assassinate him.
And the other thing I want to call out is, wow, props to Tomino for having a character become pregnant. I mean, that's pretty rare even now in modern anime. For it to happen in this show is, I was really shocked. It was so great because I got to use my super soap opera powers in order to decipher that. And I didn't actually think that I was going to be right because it doesn't happen in anime. But it happens just like it happens in a soap opera. And I was right. And just really unexpected.
So before we go into the ending, I do have a question for you. But to transition into it, the weird thing I feel is, I feel like it's pretty indirect, but I feel like Cheryl and Gije having sex is pretty decently spelled out. But it, like, Bess and Harlula's relationship seem really chaste at points. Like, so it clearly is just something that happened off. Like, they seem definitely intimate, but I wasn't just like, I was like, oh, they've had sex? All right. I mean, they clearly have a relationship. They clearly care for each other. But it was a little more surprising that, like, oh, it's never like, you know, you see, like, Bess or Harlula coming out of the other one's room after. Whereas that definitely happened once or twice with Gije and Cheryl. So I feel like... I just felt like that was a little more implicitly stated. I mean, obviously being pregnant tells you all you need to know about Bess and Harlula's relationship. But I just felt it odd that they didn't have a little more indication of how far their relationship was along.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I agree with you. In general, I do like that Tomino has a lot of relationship stuff happen off screen that you know, essentially things are happening, you know, I can't basically in his mind, I can't show you everything that happens 24 hours a day for all of these characters. So I like a lot of times in a lot of his shows, the way that he sort of makes it clear that, you know what, there's background things that happened and this is now the point at which we're picking up again. But I agree with you in this particular case that there could have been a little bit more intimacy between them later in the series to make it clear.
Oh, which brings me into the one thing that I didn't feel we touched on, but I feel was important. What did you think about Gije coming back and basically being, like, for a short time, but it was clearly supposed to be longer in the series, him being the third Ideon pilot and kind of being, like, the second most important and defector to the...
I really liked it. I thought it was very satisfying because we had seen him so early in the series. He's the first antagonist, and then, you know, he goes away for a little bit, then he changes a little, comes back, then he changes again, disappears, then he comes back again. So I thought that was actually really satisfying because we saw him in different stages and then we got to this point. And he kind of comes to the crew as almost a religious desire to see the magnificence of the Ideon.
Because, yeah, I feel like he started out super devoted to Harlula and Carla and wanting to get her back. And then when he comes back the second time, he's like, he feels betrayed by her and he wants revenge on the Ideon who showed him up so many times. And yeah, the third time he comes back and he's still devoted. Like, in a way, he's kind of like, oh, now I understand what Carla was trying to tell me all this time. But in a way, now he understands her, but he's now not devoted to her, but this greater idea of, like, what is the Ideon, and more importantly, the ID trying to tell us. And yeah, so that's an interesting, I didn't think about that, but yeah, that's an interesting progress of his character.
And I really liked it because I was also very surprised, but not in a this doesn't make sense way, which easily could have been. But I, like I said, I felt like it was very satisfying that it came together well.
Yeah, I'm a little curious. How much more, since he was definitely being a lot more implicit, how much more we would have seen of Cheryl and EJ had the show got its full run? But c'est la vie.
All right, so should we talk about episode 39?
So another thing that is clearly, like, this was supposed to happen in a different way, but we had to rush it with the whole Carlala just being transported to her dad's super mega death ship. And it's just like, oh, the EDA just transports them there so they can have this conversation.
But she goes with not Job John.
Yeah, I can't remember his name, but he's not Job John.
I just thought it was a very strange choice of who to send with her.
The only weirder choice would have been like Bento, or once again, that blue-haired guy who's like Bess's second in command, whose name I super don't know.
Yeah, I thought that was just strange because there are so many other people on the ship who aren't pilots of the Ideon that, yeah, anyway, that was strange. And
or who would have, like, who had, like, a different or more, or, like, a stronger connection to Carlala? I guess they needed that scene where not Job John is like, oh, if Bess didn't get with you, I totally would have.
I forgot about that! Like, yo! This is not the time, okay?
Yeah, Carlala's been like, yeah, okay. You. That's like, interesting. Thanks.
That's what I wanted to know right before we die, is that you wanted to bang me one time. Thanks so much. That was the really important message.
But, the weirdest of that dude's one scene threw me off of what I was saying.
So she goes, has this conversation with her dad.
Right. But it's very clear, in my opinion, that she was supposed to be captured, or maybe, you know, they were supposed to be in some situation and Carlala would have went over there to talk to her dad, but they just didn't have the time to set that up. So they just have the Ide magically bring her there. And then eventually not Job John and her escape after, like, negotiations between her dad and her break down. And he's like, oh, those are all good points you make. Yeah, I'm going to still wipe out humanity and all of you and take the EDA power for myself and kill the Emperor, who we saw, like, one scene and a wide shot from a distance.
It's very important to get rid of that guy.
I don't know what his policies are, why so many different factions of the Buff Clan all want to kill this dude, but he must die. And then it seems like they die, but it seems then the Ideon protects them, and then we just get a, oh, by the way, this is what happens.
In the episode's defense, it is only a voiceover for the last 3 minutes. So, I mean, on the whole, that's... Maybe I was saying this after I finished watching it, too. Maybe it's just not my first rodeo, but that didn't bother me too much.
Although...
But I'm also prepared for these things.
But it's also a pretty heavy amount of... By the way, since the two races weren't able to work together, the Ide decides to kill them both. Both sentient races are wiped out. Hope that the... Basically...
Across the universe. Yeah. Not just the currently fighting in a little battle here in this part of space.
Basically, every human and every Buff Clan member, the Ide just murders all of
across
them.
Across the universe, and then shoots babies everywhere. I didn't know what the shooting babies thing
well,
was.
Well, it's like Carlala's unborn baby, and who's the Christ?
Lou?
Yeah, and Lou become ambassadors for all the other ghost babies that the Ide...
Because there was definitely more than two ghost babies, okay?
But those were the ambassador ghost babies.
Oh, all right. Well, is Carlala's... It's more like an ambassador fetus. It's not even... Yeah. Not, it's an unborn... Doesn't exist.
So yeah, those two ghost things, and then all these other ghost things spread back over the universe, and hopefully next time they'll get it right. The end.
I thought you had a really good insight, Al, about the sixth civilization and where that sort of comes into this.
Because, I mean, they don't, but maybe it's a little more in the movie, but it's super clear that the sixth civilization was this huge civilization that spread all over the, not even our galaxy, but a bunch of galaxies, and then they're just gone. And one of the big mysteries of the series is, what happened to the sixth civilization? It was like, everybody sat down for dinner one night. They had this empire that spanned multiple galaxies. Next thing you know, everybody is dead.
Or just gone.
Yeah. And so, and I think it's pretty, I think the show generally implies that, yeah, they basically, the Ide tested them, they failed, the seventh civilization, there's the humans and the Buff Clan, and they have failed once again.
And that also implies that there were 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 civilizations, theoretically, prior to that. And keeps the Ide on as this mysterious being. I mean, it's not, you know, I feel as though for the longest time, especially maybe even up until the end, everybody, including us, I sort of assumed that the sixth civilization created the Ideon, but more than likely they didn't.
Some schmo bunch of colonists found the, you know, the solo ship in the Ide. They went and, what do you call it, went on an adventure, and whatever crucial moment when they had to make the right decision, they also made the wrong decision, and the sixth civilization and whoever else was around at the time, who all paid the price for that one.
Now, this is just a random question. Don't know how to speculate about it, but do you think that when Tomino started the series, he planned to have them fail, or do you think he got mad that the series was canceled?
That is a good question, because I was kind of thinking about it. From doing my Tomino panel, I feel like the more stressed about a production he is, the nastier the ending is. So I have a suspicion that if he didn't plan it, generally he must have been ticked about something, because I feel like that's usually when you get your darker endings. Because I feel like when he usually comes away positive, like Turn A or King Gainer,
or even Original,
you get your, yeah, you get your more upbeat endings. And when you can just tell that he's obviously butting heads, you get your kill 'em all endings.
But Original was canceled, so. But that was early. I don't know. Yeah, I feel like maybe it wasn't the cancel that pissed him off.
So yeah, no, I think it would be a great question for him if he ever came back for another, you know, in another American Con. That would definitely be one of my questions, was like, yeah, was there a point in the story at which the Buff Clan and the humans were able to pass that test, that they were really able to rally around Carla Lush's child and realize that there was a way for both species to exist and thrive, and basically the Ide helps them as opposed to destroying them.
Yeah, I think I would be fascinated to know at which, when he decided how it would end. Yeah.
This episode's food for thought.
Okay, so our food for thought, since we're wrapping up 2017, and we don't want to go into our favorite anime and manga stuff. We'll be doing some big posts about that, and we'll do a year in review podcast in January. So this time we wanted to talk about and ask people about their favorite 2017 things that weren't anime and manga.
Listen to our song!
Me out.
すり減らす日々君はいらない、涙が枯れた乾いた肌に、コスモス空を駆け抜けて、祈りを今君のもとへ、コスモス空を駆け抜けて、祈りを今
answer to the food for thought.
So we got a couple of answers from Twitter. And so Elliot Page said, I went to a post-revolution Russian art exhibition, and that was nice. Also Persona 5. Also visiting Shoryu Ramen in London. I did not go there when I was in London, but now I'm like, wait, that delicious ramen place? Sounds good. I like the variety in that. Something very cultured, art exhibition, and then Persona 5.
Sheesh, Kate. Persona 5 is obviously very cultured. It's about Phantom Thieves.
I mean, I'm not... It's not like society. It's not as if I'm saying Persona 5 is bad or something. Totally not what I was doing. And then Metal Caveman, Dan, said, John Wick 2 was awesome. A ton of great metal albums, which should be obvious based on his name, so he would know. I'm going to read these because I have no idea anything about them. Highlights include 1755 by Moonspell and Two Paths by Insiferum. I don't know anything about metal, so I trust you, Dan. And he began working on a project currently at almost 90,000 words. I don't know what that project... I hope it's a novel if it's that long.
It's a visual novel, Kate.
Maybe, right? Could be. That was very mysteriously worded, so who knows? Could be fanfic, right? the Twilight level length of fanfic.
An RPG might have that much text.
So what about you?
Certain things. I just want to mention that since I couldn't watch Star Trek Discovery, since it was on that CBS All Access, and like I was, I'll watch the first episode, and then you had to sign up for All Access just to watch the first free episode, and I was like, I'll eventually be on like Hulu, Netflix, or something else, so I'll just get it there. So instead, I went back and I started rewatching Deep Space Nine, one of my favorites, if not my favorite, Star Trek.
I was gonna ask, why did you pick that one, but it's your favorite one.
Also, I feel like if you just watch, like, because they appear occasionally on BBC America, interestingly enough. And so whenever my parents, because I don't have cable, but my parents have cable. So whenever I go over to my parents, sometimes I'll just watch a random Next Generation or like Voyager episode. And they're so episodic most of the time that you can just watch a random one and it doesn't matter. But DS9 really had, I mean, it had had a lot of one-off episodes, but it was the one Star Trek series that had like a really detailed meta plot that really rewarded you for watching them all in order. So that is the series that you get the most out of watching it all in order. I think Enterprise might have also had like a meta plot, but I didn't ever watch enough Enterprise to know about that. And Voyager technically is them getting home, but it's just a way of having a lot of one-off episodes. Going back to Deep Space Nine, I really like the two things I noticed is, man, this was a really good show that I feel like holds up. If you like wanted to see a Star Trek series with a little structure to it and a little bit of a little more of a complexity, Next Generation is very good, but it has a very utopian view of the Federation in the universe. Whereas I feel like Deep Space Nine generally has that, but it has a little more grit to it, while still, because I don't want to be the old like, it's the Edgelord one. I feel like it still has the high ideals and hope for humanity and the universe, but it's a little more nuanced, and humans are still kind of scumbag, you know, there's still depravity and darkness to them, but maybe there's more hope as well. And I think that it's a little more balanced. I think it is a good, and it's just interesting. The second thing I wanted to mention was, it's just interesting for me to go back and like, what parts do I remember and which parts have I forgotten, and like which parts, because I watched the show when it was on TV, so it's, you know, that was teenage Alan watching that show when it came out, and now Alan in his 40s watching Deep Space Nine, like certain things resonate more with me, certain things I pick up more, or just, you know, I catch more now with also it helps with a little bit of like, since I know the general plot, I know, oh, I see what you did there, and you know, oh, you know where the character's ending, so you can kind of see how their character progresses, because I feel like a lot of the characters have some really interesting arcs where they're very different characters by the end. So I'm pretty much like a quarter of the way through the final season, so I'll probably finish it by the end of the year. If not, the beginning of January, I will knock that all out. And I think that was a really fun rewatch.
And I've heard so many good things about the new Star Trek, so hopefully you'll get to watch that soon.
Yeah, I figure that eventually CBS will filter it out to like, hopefully, like, all right, now that the first season is out, we'll put on like Hulu or Netflix or something, and come watch the second season on CBS All Access. So I'm just basically waiting for that moment, and so I can watch it without having to get CBS All Access.
So I think the first thing I want to call out, and I'm going to do two back-to-back here because I'm not going to talk a lot about this first one because I've talked a lot about it already on this podcast, which is, I just cannot do this part without saying Zelda, Breath of the Wild, Game of the Year, amazing, incredible, such a big part of my 2017, and that I'm really looking forward to the DLC that should be out hopefully in the next week or two, I guess, even though there hasn't been a direct about. I thought for sure there would be a direct about what the heck it's going to be. Maybe there will be. I don't know. But obviously, I did at least two episodes of the Speakeasy. I talked about this game, so like, I'm not going to talk about it again. I just couldn't reasonably not mention it here. One of the other things I really loved was Spider-Man Homecoming. Loved this movie. I think it is now my favorite Spider-Man movie. And I really, really feel they nailed the character. I was a big fan of the 2001 Spider-Man, but I think this was better. It felt a little more grounded, a little more subtle, I guess. And I loved that it wasn't an origin story. I think that's the thing that like so many people have called out about it, that they didn't do that, and that they were just able to really capture New York high school life that I don't, it's such a unique experience that I thought it was really interesting that they were able to capture that. It was just one of the many subtle points in the series that I really liked.
And I think, I don't know if you were going to mention this, but in many ways, I think the most interesting part to me, and I've seen other people mention this, is that they escaped one of the biggest curses of the Marvel movies. And can you think of it? Or The Vulture, I thought, was an interesting villain because so many of the criticisms of most of the Marvel movies is, the heroes were great, the action story was great, even like the ones like Winter Soldier and the stuff, it said more than just, you know, good guys beat up bad guys. But even in something like Captain America: Civil War, everybody's complaint is, and the villain was there, and I guess I remember him. But mostly he was like he was an element there for the heroes to beat while the more interesting story played out. But I feel like Michael Keaton as the Vulture having like... being somewhat relatable, understandable. He's still obviously a villain. He still does a lot of scummy things. It's clear why Spider-Man has to take him down. But I feel like he just doesn't feel like this placeholder villain that they just have to beat up at the end, because that is the standard formula that needs to be done. And, you know, I think that there's an important lesson to be learned in that.
Yeah, and I feel the struggle Peter has with confronting who the Vulture is. It is really good in this movie, and I just, you know, I love Spider-Man. I love Peter Parker, and I really thought they did a great job of showing more than I usually see in any superhero movies how difficult it is for Peter to be a teenager and do this, because there's so many melancholy moments in this movie where you see Peter making a sort of an adult decision that he can't go and enjoy that party. He can't just forget that this is going on, that there's so much responsibility on him despite him being so young. I really liked that has been always a central tenet of something that Spider-Man, that Peter has to confront a lot, especially at the beginning of his story. Obviously, it changes over time as he gets older, but I just really thought that was good in here, because this movie was able to make me really feel that sadness, but at the same time the humor was great. They really nailed it, and I felt confident about that from seeing him in the Civil War movie. Mm-hmm. That okay, they've got the voice so well, and I that was totally here. And I think this is also the first Spider-Man, and this kid is, the guy who plays him is really young, so it makes sense, but the first Spider-Man that feels really like a teenager. He really, 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 like, looks the part of the teenager. And also just very impressive that a lot of the acrobatics he does himself in this movie, which is really cool. Yeah, I just have had so much love for this movie.
Oh, while we're talking about superhero stuff, because I just rewatched it, I really liked the Lego Batman movie. I thought that it felt like, all right, the Lego movie was so surprisingly good. And they're like, all right, we're going to take Lego Batman and put him in his own movie. And you're like, Lego Batman was really funny in the Lego movie, but he's kind of this weird one-joke character. And they wisely keep him not too in the movie, so you never get tired of that one joke. Can he do a whole movie? And I thought, actually, you realize, Lego Batman is basically the most jokey form of Batman in that movie, whereas Lego Batman in the Lego Batman movie is almost this kind of love letter to all of Batman. Like, they expand him out and kind of let him touch the full range of Batman, from dark, brooding guy to, like, even jokey Batman and all the parts in between. And I thought it actually has a fun movie with a weird Batman and Joker's yaoi relationship theme at the same time. And the whole thing about, like, the Bat family. And
I feel as though you unsold it for some people and sold it for other people with that assessment.
It is an amazingly good Lego movie version. Lego movie version of the Batman story, which I think really impressed me a lot.
Was that this year?
Yeah, it was at the very beginning of the year.
Okay.
Because remember, we were determining, we found out what the most profitable movie of this year was, and then
Animated movie
of this year, and then we had to look out what else was up against it.
Right. We're not discussing that.
Yes. So that's why I knew it was this year. But yes, also I like that they went to some of the most obscure Batman villains, like the Eraser and Polka Dot Man. Oddly enough, they didn't have Calendar Man, because I was discussing the movie with my brother recently, and I'm like, he's in the Batman Arkham Asylum games and those various sequels, but he wasn't in this one. And they went for some of the obscure ones, so I was like, huh, no Calendar Man. Interesting.
I've just been deciding which books I want to talk about, so I'm narrowing it down in my mind. Okay, I think I'll call out Thick as Thieves by Megan Whalen Turner. So this is the fifth book in the Queen's Thief series. I feel like it's a lesser known fantasy series, mostly because, or partially because there's a long time between books, maybe. But it's really good. It kind of combines a lot of It pulls a lot from the mythos of sort of like Greek and Roman mythology, but then it's creating its own fantasy world, but it sort of takes place in a, like, kind of a region like that, and just has these gods that don't interfere a ton with the humans, but every once in a while kind of make their presence known. And each book in the series features Gen. The first book is the thief, and he's the main character there, and then he appears in all the other books, but they sort of shift perspectives a little bit on the world. So the fifth book is a completely different perspective, different characters, and it almost stands alone. The fourth book could almost stand alone as well. And I think that's one of the great things about this series. You gain a lot from reading them in order, absolutely. Especially the first one, you definitely have to read that one first, but the world is really, like, thoughtfully complex, and it's a very character-driven story. It's not real epic fantasy. So I thought the fifth installment was one of the best that she's written for the series. It also got this beautiful new packaging for all the first four books and the new fifth book. That's really good. So if you've never read Megan Whalen Turner, so fantastic, so great. Again, it's just like a character that you will absolutely love. And the reason I think that the series shifts perspectives is because Gen as a character is, he's a very surprising character, and so, like, if you were always in his head, you might figure certain things out too much, so I think she's very smart about switching the perspective, because then it's harder to sort of figure out the complexity of the plot and exactly what's what.
I wanted to mention some history podcasts I've been listening to that are really good. The first one I want to talk about is History on Fire. It's written by an Italian history professor who moved over to the United States. He's also an MMA fighter who is married to a female MMA fighter who's also a producer of the show. And so it's just a great history podcast. I feel like he talks about some interesting characters in history. And I feel like he likes people who are very messy. Like his episode on Teddy Roosevelt really shows how interestingly progressive and bold and interesting he was, and yet how in other ways he was equally terrible and in ways that we would consider like near villainous and oddly, weirdly conservative, all in one package. He did this great series of episodes about, I forgot this name, but of this crazy Renaissance artist who was also a duelist, who's basically working for the church and snubbing his nose at them at the same time. His current series that he has 2 of 3 episodes on is about the first black man to become the world heavyweight boxing champion, and generally like the cultural and racial revolution all around him. And once again, here's another character who is filled with many wonderful attributes and yet a lot of darkness and like serious character flaws. And I feel like all the characters that he presents in the series, you get a great amount of sympathy for, even though he shows you a lot of not so great things they've done as well. But I feel like you come away enriched every time.
Since you brought up podcasts, I'm actually going to sidebar into a couple podcasts before I talk about another book, which is, I got to call out because I fell in love with it this year, My Favorite Murder. Any true crime or detective fans, it's a must listen to podcast. Well, it isn't actually, because it seems to either hit people exactly in the right spot or to just like offend them greatly, but it's a podcast about true crime that's also a comedy podcast. So if you kind of enjoy those two things and have sort of a dark sense of humor about it, then the show is for you. I love it. And I actually don't love true crime that much, but the way that it's presented here is it works really well for me because of the humor aspect, that I can sort of walk away with a whole bunch of really interesting history and knowledge and be scared, but also laugh a lot along the way. And I think that's usually the reason I tend to away from true crime, because it scares me so much, but it's a really kind of like nice package for it. And since Al was talking about history podcasts, I wanted to mention, You Must Remember This Podcast. It's all about classic Hollywood, so, and a little bit sometimes modern one-off episodes about some modern things, like she did an episode about Bruce Lee and Brandon Lee, so, but she sort of goes into really, really well-researched classic Hollywood, like mysteries and just interesting people from the era. Sometimes most episodes are focused on particular actors. Sometimes she's done like studio series. She did this amazing Charles Manson series and about its like connection to Hollywood and, you know, like what was happening during the time that the Manson family was coming up and like how it connected to history and culture and Hollywood. And it's really a fantastic series. And she does sort of like seasons, so she'll do some subject and do a bunch of podcasts about that and then take a break and then do a lot of research. And she also has just an amazing voice, Karina Longworth. You just want to listen to her talk about anything. So fantastic for history and Hollywood.
The other history podcast I wanted to mention, actually, I was about to say, Kate, before I mentioned the other history podcast, I was like, don't you know, hasn't anime fandom taught you that anything older than 10 years ago is ancient history? Thereby, Bruce Lee and Brandon Lee, that's what you call it, that's the classic age of cinema at this point.
I mean, Bruce Lee, obviously, I feel as though would count, but Brandon Lee, I wouldn't.
Over 10 years now.
I mean, it is. You're right. I was wrong.
But the other history podcast I wanted to mention is the Romance of the Three Kingdoms podcast. He's getting pretty close to the end of, basically going through the whole Romance of the Three Kingdoms. So if you think start now, by the time you get through all 140 episodes that are already out, if you start now, you basically finish and the series will be done. But he goes through all of the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, chapter by chapter. What's great is that since it's, you know, a classic work of Chinese literature, it just assumes that you know a lot of the references that go on. Like, you know, one character will be like, ah, yes, you are much like this one ancient general from the spring and autumn period. And another person will be like, oh, ho, 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 so true. And then it's like, yes! And then he did this tactic. And then he'll be like, yeah, and they don't explain that tactic because they just assume that you know what it is. So let me explain who this general is in the spring and autumn period. And then let me explain the tactic. So then when it happens, you're like, oh, I see what he's going for there. And sometimes he'll just do, like, little supplemental episodes. Like, all right, I can't explain, like, mid-chapter. I have to, like, take a supplemental episode and explain this part of, like, the Warring States period. So that... And if you don't know anything about Romance of the Three Kingdoms, it's the kind of dramatization of the Three Kingdoms period. If you want, like, the real or pretty real, there's the Record of the Three Kingdoms, which is the much more boring Lu Bu.
Not Dynasty Warriors version. Yeah.
It's like, this general took this many guys here, they fought here, they won this battle. Whereas, you know, this is general. If you ever wondered what Dynasty Warriors came from, it basically came from this book. Because, you know.
And it's referenced so much in animes.
Oh, yeah. That was going to be my general reason to listen to this podcast. But, yeah. You know, it'll be like, Jinkei held this pass against 10,000 guys all on his own. And, you know, obviously that did not happen in the real record, but, you know, the author, one, has a little bit of a political agenda, but two, you know, wants to tell a rip-roaring story, so all the heroes are superheroes, and all the great generals are super geniuses. You know, everyone's playing, you know, three moves ahead of each other and trying to, I know what you know, what you know, what I know. But really makes what would otherwise be an impenetrable kind of dry book very accessible to anyone who maybe doesn't have a huge amount of the required or assumed Chinese cultural knowledge. And after a major character dies in the novel, he'll do a supplementary episode basically comparing the real life character to the character in the book and what's changed and what he thinks about the difference between the real character and the fictional characters, because some of it is just supposition, but you know, he gives a little bit of his, that's the part where you get the most insight into his opinions. But I feel like it's invaluable to have like that, those section of this is what the real, you know, Lu Bu, or this is the real Tao Tao was like. Once again, as I mentioned, the romance of the three kingdoms comes so much in video games and anime and manga and pretty much anything out of China and Japan and probably anywhere in Asia, that I feel like it's worth knowing about it to appreciate a little more when it comes up in those things. And once again, it's just an entertaining story, and definitely the host of the podcast really lets it connect to you in a fun way.
So last thing I'm going to call out are the books in the series To All the Boys I've Loved Before. So there's three books. The first one is To All the Boys I've Loved Before. The second book is P.S. I Love You. And the third book, which came out this year, is Always and Forever Largene. So these are probably... They're basically exactly what I want from a romance series. Only have I ever really felt this good about romance in manga. I feel like this was just hit exactly everything I wanted. So it has a really perfect hook at the beginning of the series, which is Largene is Korean-American girl who loves to scrapbook and journal and things. And so her way of kind of closing a relationship, which she's never had. She's never had any relationships. She's in high school, but she's had a lot of, you know, guys that she's fallen in love with. So she writes them a letter, but she does not mail the letter. She, you know, writes all her feelings down, addresses, folds the envelope, and then puts it in her hat box. And that's sort of her way of closure for her feelings. And then she can move on. So early on in the first book, these letters get sent out. So all of a sudden, everyone that she's ever had a crush on since she was like in sixth grade gets a letter, and she starts dealing with the kind of comical like fallout.
She put stamps on them.
Yeah. And so it mostly centers on two guys, Peter and Josh. And Peter's sort of the first one to approach her and be like, hey, so I got your letter. And she's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And they end up pretending to be in a relationship because of certain circumstances. And
he's in her circumstances.
Like, very lighthearted, but also has a lot of heart. Largene's family is such a great bunch of characters in this series. She has an older sister and a younger sister, and like their sister friendship is so good. And like kind of the complications of the romance are there, but it's not too dark. It's not too sad. And it has a really, really great voice. Largene's voice is so funny. I feel as though these books are like exactly what Jenny Han was. She was born to write these three books. They were so good. The first two books tell a complete story. The second book takes place like moments after the first book. The third book is sort of a companion book that takes place a little bit later. But I thought it was a really, really satisfying ending to the series. And the story is getting a movie next year. It's already been cast. I think they finished filming. It's probably in, like, post-production at this point. So I'm really excited about the movie. I don't know, you know, I feel like YA adaptions don't really have the greatest track record movie-wise, but
the source material is strong enough that you at least have hope.
Good. And the casting is good. So I have a lot of hope for it. I'm definitely excited about it. I can't wait to see it. So if you like romance, if you're looking for something that's just so much fun, I would really recommend these. And I actually don't read a ton of romance novel. I don't really, it's just not, I'm trying to explore it a lot more, but it's just not something that I generally pick up. So, but I was absolutely hooked. I cannot recommend these books enough. I think you will love Lara Jean. You will laugh at her antics. I laughed so hard in these books and also got very emotional and happy. So absolutely 100% recommended.
So before I go into my last one, I just want to give some quick ones. Since it's me, I just wanted to mention that one of my favorite games this year was Fate Extella. I was glad that they brought back the Fate Extra universe. I always felt like Tamamo and Nero were good characters, so I'm glad they're still getting work, as it were. And that game is already getting a sequel, so I'm really eager to play that one. And I just wanted to give a little shout out to my favorite storyline from Grand Order this year, which was in Shinjuku, because it was all about Moriarty, and I think they really got like the double and triple planning of Professor Moriarty, with some interesting, who's the Sebastian with his like right hand man, interesting call outs also to that character. And I thought it was a fun chapter of Fate Grand Order, but I just really like how they got Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty in that chapter. I thought that was super fun and interesting takes on both of those characters who had so many different iterations. I really found Type Moon's version fun. But the last thing I wanted to call out is a very cool YouTube channel called Today I Found Out, which is just 15-minute videos on just a variety of just little interesting subjects. From everything like, is there actually a card that McDonald's and Burger King give out that will give you free fast food for life? And the answer is yes, there is. Or they'll have other things of like, why is the legend that witches ride booms exist? And the answer is actually rather interesting. I just feel like they're extremely well researched. They always have like sources in the basically the extra section, and they're just great little topics of conversation starting topics. And they do like an episode every other day, so you know, not everyone is going to be one you're interested in, but I feel like they have such an interesting variety of topics that it's just worth being subscribed to, just so anytime you stop into YouTube, you know, you can scroll through and say, oh, that one's interesting, I could skip that one. Oh, that's interesting. And it's a great little channel, definitely worth a look. The most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
So let's start with some numbers news. The end of the year has come upon us, so there's a lot of top-selling lists, best-of lists, all that. So the official list of the best-selling manga in Japan came out. Also, light novels. I put those on here, but I don't really care about that. I was like, I guess we could also talk about that. There wasn't an anime.
I mean, other
one
than
out yet.
Other than Your Name, do you give a rat's bum about any of the light novel titles?
No, but you say that like you do. That you deeply do, Al, but just not me.
But I didn't put these on the list. If I put them on the list, then you could question why I
said I put it there just because I also put them. They were like next to the manga, so it got put there. But
are you saying you're not secretly a Saga of Evil Tanya fan?
Yeah, it took me a minute to remember what that was when I was looking at the list. The only thing I think is interesting is to sort of compare what's the top selling volume, as in like this is the thing that sold the most numbers, and then versus what's the top selling franchise, and if there's any like weird things or any things that show up that aren't on both. So the top selling light novel for the whole year was Your Name. And then also some other version of Your Name is also on. I was not quite
sure what the difference between these two your names are.
Is one of them based on, like, I don't remember. I thought there was, like, a... like two different manga adaptations, or I don't remember.
Something. This is not manga.
No, I was just wondering if, like, one was based on the movie and one was based on that other manga adaptation. That's what I meant.
Oh, I have no idea. If someone knows, tell us. I'm sure that if I just Googled this, I'd probably know, but I'm just not going to. And that's the only thing I really have to say about the light novel stuff. Thoughts, Al?
My only thing is, and I've never seen one episode, but I see it, like, pop up every once in a while. I don't think it's anything that either of us would be interested in. But it is a, like, I feel like I know a little bit about the rest of the titles. But it's a series that comes up enough that I'm a little surprised I don't know at least a cursory amount of information about.
Does it have an anime?
Yeah. It's like, it also comes up because it's on Crunchyroll. I see sometimes people talk about that series because of that.
Yeah, it doesn't ring a bell. I mean, not that it necessarily would, but...
It seems like one of those series that seems to have a fan base that I have no connection to. Kind of like Tokyo Ghoul, but at least I was aware that Tokyo Ghoul was popular. But also seeing it here just reminded me of, oh yeah, I do, like, occasionally see people talking about that. I guess that actually is a series with the fan base that but it's also a series I know nothing about.
Beyond that, I don't think there's any real surprises. You know, Sword Art Online remains number one franchise-wise.
Although I am a little surprised that Arrow Manga Sensei is as high as it is. More because it seems so trashy that I expected it to be lower. Like, the stuff that's usually here is usually slightly trashy with some story, whereas Arrow Manga just seems pure trash.
And then Your Name is in there.
Yeah. But that's a show, that is a series with actual mainstream appeal.
That's true. And it had a big, successful movie that, you know, recently came out. So that makes sense. It's not as if that will be on the list forever. Mm-hmm. It's more of a right now.
Plus, it broke through with only one book, whereas most of these have like 4 to 6 books in the year, and they can all add up together to
be... In a year?
Yeah.
Right. If I had paid attention to that list more, it was like, Sword Art Online this volume, Sword Art Online this volume. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Just dash them out. They write themselves!
I mean, just to bring up Niyuishin again, like, one of the gimmicks of Katanagatari is that it's 12 volumes long, and he published one a month.
Whew, that's an incredible feat, even though I hate him. I acknowledge that that's a lot of work.
That was your light novel moment.
Looking at the manga, moving on to that. So I thought it was interesting that for top-selling series, we only got the top 10, but then when it's top-selling by volume, it's like the top 50. So I feel like it's a little harder to... Like, I'm kind of curious what past 10 looks like on this series list, because nothing in, like, by volume-wise is an anomaly at all until you get to, like, past 15. Then every once in a while, something will, like, break in that has a lot less of a frequency than the shonen stuff. Like, Silver Spoon shows up, like, way down there, Kimi ni Todoke shows up.
I know March Comes Like a Lion was pretty... I mean, it's the problem of why so many Jose and shoujo artists will occasionally just be like, I'm just going to do shonen or seinen for a while. They just have a bigger market share. And so...
Because the top 10 is all firmly, mostly Jump, and then a few other things in there. You know, of course, One Piece tops the list.
And it's all super shonen-y.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's really, like, the usual suspects at this point. And although I was surprised that 10 was Magi still, I feel as though the interest in that series, at least stateside, I think, like, came and went in a flash, and I feel like there's not a lot of...
Well, you know, this list is interesting because I was saying, well, I feel like it's Sunday's, like, mainstream hit in Japan, but Sunday Stuff A, Sunday Stuff never just hits over here the way that it does in Japan. And it is kind of definitely like a fallen magazine. I feel like they used to be the big competitor for Jump, and now, especially now with, you know, Kodansha being the other big one, I feel like they've kind of fallen a little behind. But yeah, the other one that like strikes me as odd, not odd, but an interesting insight into the Japanese and American fandom, is the fact that Kingdom is number 3.
And I feel like it was also last year it was definitely in the top 10, so.
Yeah, and Kingdom is just a series that, as far as I can tell, is amazingly popular in Japan and no one speaks of in America. Or as far as I can tell, anywhere in the English-speaking world. It is just, what? What? What is Kingdom? And yeah, we're discussing a little bit. I mean, I think it has a lot to do with that anime being just so bootleg and like with the bad CG, and just like that first episode was not a hook, but I wonder how much that had to do. Like if it was like at least drawn okay, if we would have had a little more interest, but.
Yeah, no, I mean, that anime really did not do it. And I think everything else on the list has a popular anime or had a popular anime. And I wonder if Kingdom, like, I wonder how it did, the anime did in Japan. I also kind of wonder, because Kingdom is also, the manga is not licensed in the US. And I wonder if that's because it's like a historical, you know, like a, just like, it's not like super crazy shonen fighting superpower. I mean, like, the thing that obviously is really popular right now is My Hero Academia. So it's not that. And it's not really like that. So I wonder if that's also,
because as we were also mentioned before the podcast, Kingdom, they had a thing when the 26th volume came out to celebrate the anime being made. A bunch of people went and through this social media campaign redrew the 26th volume, all like 1,000 panels of it, and then put it online, and a bunch of like famous people like Oda and Kishimoto and Araki and even like voice actors and singers and celebrities all did panels. So it was, you know, you don't get Bomber Girl is never gonna have someone redraws volume 2 of Bomber Girl that way. I feel like you've got to be pretty like well known a series for something like that to happen. And like the Kingdom got not only one season but 2 seasons, so I mean, somebody cared about that series.
I guess I'm also, now that we're just talking about it and the historical thing, I wonder, even like, even if the anime was, say, well animated, I wonder how it would have, you know, jived with everybody. I keep seeing it on this list that makes me really want to know more about it. And now I don't really have a way to do that. I mean, it's number 3. That's very impressive. If we just take One Piece out of the equation totally, it's extremely impressive. Because I think it's amazing to see year after year that One Piece still consistently sells twice as much as the number 2 slot of, and then not only that, but it also has the, so by volume, the first 4 are all One Piece volumes, and each of those basically sells double what the number 5, like, it's just ludicrous, basically, that, like, year over year over year, One Piece just dominates. And what is this? I saw some news about Oda, like, releasing new details about the new arc or something like
that. They were supposed to go to Wano, which is
Guano?
Wano, W-A-N-O, which is like an old name for Japan. And they were supposed to go to have this Wano arc because they've got, like, this samurai guy and this ninja guy and they're doing stuff for them. But they got sidetracked by the year of Sanji.
Bad decision.
And so, like, they were supposed to make it to Wano at the end of this year, and they're still in the year of Sanji. He made a big deal of, like, yeah, don't worry, next year we're gonna definitely get to the year of Wano.
Promises, promises.
And he made some other stuff, I won't go into that, but
kill off Sanji and get on with this. All right, I have a really good permanent solution for his problem.
Kill the problem at the root.
Yeah, yes. I would like to inform everybody that I have gotten back to my One Piece read catch up. I did not catch up at the end of the year, but I'm getting back on track, so.
Now all I have to do is power through Fishman Island.
Oh, it'll be fine. If I think about what's to come, it'll be fine. So, speaking of all the Shonen Jump and whatnot, I have to mention this great bit of news that I saw, which is a Shonen Jump magazine inspires live-action drama, which sounds really great. It's called Oh My Jump, which is also a really good title. And yeah, it's like drama about making the magazine, like it's presumably office hijinks and drama.
They mentioned that they were going to bring up like urban legends of Jump.
I mean, that all sounds really fun. And I really hope that this ends up being one of those ones that maybe can get on Crunchyroll or something, because I think everybody would be really interested to see it.
Or, I mean, if not, it might be one of those series that ends up on Viki. Because, I mean, I know Blue Blazes ended up there.
You're right. So that's a good place for it. Could go on Netflix, I guess, because I think they're kind of picking up more live action stuff.
They did make that big claim that they were going to sink so many millions of dollars into picking up anime programming next year.
Let me just read you to the description, or part of this description. So it says, it is then that a mysterious man takes him to a secret club named Oh My Jump, where adults discuss their favorite Shonen Jump manga chapters and characters. So
they just have one episode devoted to Dragon Ball and one, actually just Akira Toriyama, and then one chapter about Oda.
It could be terrible, you know, or it could be mildly entertaining. So, and I think it will also depend on kind of like the references and what little Easter eggs there are and whatnot.
I've been meaning to bring this up for a while, but we've had a bunch of special episodes, so we haven't had news. Plus, there is a reason I can bring it up. So, there is the weirdest crossover, and I just randomly wanted to talk about it. So, if anybody is any kind of mecha person, you've probably heard of the semi-legendary game Virtuaon, which is this game that was like a robot fighting game. It kind of plays a little bit like if you're currently playing like Gundam Versus. It's like a third-person game. There's a whole bunch of different suits. They still make toys and figures from the original Virtuaon games, even today. They're that popular. But like that series kind of sunk into obscurity. And it's just like one of those things that like the diehard mecha fans still talk about and would be like, man, I wish they'd bring back Virtuaon, but such dreams will never happen. And then it came back in the weirdest way possible. So apparently the guy who writes a certain magical index and a certain scientific railgun and all that, he really, really likes that series. And so apparently he was talking to a bunch of Sega people and he's like, you guys should bring back Virtuaon. And they're like, all right, you want to do a crossover? So they have brought back Virtuaon as a certain magical Virtuaon. It so it has a bunch of index and railgun characters piloting old and new Virtuaon suits. And it's a game now. And you can even play a free demo of it on the PS4.
It's almost as if it's a doujin game.
Yeah, no. It's because we were discussing this when it was first announced. And as someone who's read a decent amount of Index and Railgun, there are a small amount of robots because, you know, Academy City, like the place with the psychics, has such a high level of technology. There have been people who have like mechs or even ride mechs, but they're all like super minor villains or side characters. There's not even like a main character or like friend of the any of the main characters that pilots a robot. In fact, everybody who I can think of off the top of my head who has used a giant robot has been a villain in that series. And not even like a reoccurring villain. Like for one chapter, they get beaten and then, or like one story arc, I should say. So it's not totally out of place. Like, I think the storyline is there's like a Virtuon fighting competition in Academy City and a bunch of characters are getting involved because there's something secret going on in the competition. But it is also weirdly, it's somewhere in between totally not out of possibility in the universe, but still feeling slightly out of character.
Did you play any of it?
I played a little bit of it yesterday. I basically played the tutorial because that was about as much as I could get through not being able to. Because it's actually apparently a slightly complicated game. Not like totally unplayable, but I'm thinking that if I like knew the nuances of the controls a little better, I could. But it basically has like the demo and then like a free play mode. I'm sorry, it has the tutorial and then like a free play mode where you could test out like all the basic units. I'm sure they have like hidden units. Obviously, you have to play the game to get those. But if you just want to test like regular units, they have like a free play mode for that. So it's, you know, fairly, it's a good sampling of what the game is about, what it plays like.
Which is?
Like a third person thing. You're in an arena. It's a lot about dashing and kind of like a 3D fighter, only with robots. Like I said, if you've played any of the Gundam Versus games that are popular right now, it plays a lot like that.
Are you going to get the full game? Are we getting the full game?
As far as I know, nobody has picked up the license for that.
Oh, it's so they just, so sometimes they just put out demos for games that aren't getting...
It's just that it's region, the PS4 is region free enough that I basically downloaded the Japanese demo.
Okay.
That's why I couldn't, like, that's why I said I couldn't. I'm not sure if I fully got all the nuances of the fighting because it was all in Japanese. So I'm like, I got the basic controls down. I could beat Index, but Railgun totally kicked my ass.
Got it. Okay, so just gonna end on some...
Oh!
Yes.
Kate. So, Kate, just before we go on to the last news article, if you could mix a random light novel and a vaguely related game, do you have some...
Boy, that would have been a really good food for thought that I could then spend time thinking about, because I feel as though the light novels that I know aren't action-based, although I guess Kino's Journey is a light novel, so maybe there's something there with Kino.
Kino's Journey cooking game.
No, not unless you're trying to kill everyone you encounter.
Or being Kino's Journey. Oh no! The main ingredient is people in this battle.
So I guess that. There you go.
That's the bonus food for thought for anybody listening.
Yeah. What about you, Al?
Devil is a Part-Timer Fast Food Management Simulator. Fast Food Franchise Tycoon.
Okay, so just want to end on some... I don't know, I'm going to call this, like, sending good wishes news. So, they've announced that Detective Conan is going on an extended hiatus. There's no, like, time frame specified in this. So, Conan actually just came back from hiatus, like at the end of November. It was on, like, a 3-chapter hiatus for supposedly research. But now it's going on a hiatus for the mangaka's medical treatment. Obviously, they're not, you know, they're keeping private whatever is going on, and for him to, like, recharge. So, he, of course, wrote, you know, some very, like, joking things about overdoing it and then also needing time to play Animal Crossing. But yeah, I mean, you know, like, Conan's such a fixture that it's, like, kind of a big deal for it to go on an extended hiatus, and I kind of wonder, you know, if maybe this could mean that also maybe Conan will be wrapping up in, you know, in the near future.
future. I mean, we're on, like, volume 94. Maybe they're going to try to get to, like, 100.
I mean, this might be a little different, but I do remember when Hada was wrapping up Hayate, he did basically go on a 2-month hiatus where he, you know, took stock of, like, what plot thread should I wrap up? You know, how should I aim the story at a conclusion? And all those things. People still say, I should have taken another month for the garbage ending that he gave us. Other than kind of neglecting Maria, I think he did a decent job. But I wonder if he does have, like, some surgery or just, like, basically medically enforced rest that they might kill two birds with one stone, let him get the rest after whatever happens to him, but also take that opportunity to, like, all right, let's take stock. Well, you know, you don't have to draw anything, but let's take stock of where the manga has been, where it's going, maybe start moving this into the end game if we need to. Or if we need to move it into the end game, what pieces do we have to, you know, firmly set down to set up the ending?
Yeah, I just, when I saw that, you know, he is going on medical treatment, which is, you know, I hope, yeah, good wishes to him, hopefully. But yeah, it just made me think, like, oh, is this also possibly a chance for them to start thinking about that? I worry about Weekly Shonen Sunday if and when Conan finishes, but that can't be the only reason for it to, like, you know, charge on.
Don't worry, Kate. Hada said it's hard to work on his next series.
Then I wish him well also. All right, so that's it for 2017, and our next show will be a sort of a year in review of, you know, of all the news and what happened in 2017.
And we'll also be talking about the Ideon movies.
Oh man, now you've locked me into watching that before the next podcast.
Yes, Kate, you have to. Shit. Now you have to see how, what do you call it, how everybody gets murderated in the Ideon movies.
And we might have some blog and podcast announcements next month as well.
Yay!
That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.